Hello and welcome to School Me, the National Education Association's podcast dedicated to helping educators thrive in the early stages of their career. I'm your host, Natika Samuels. We're all getting more than a little bit restless in isolation and are eager to return to our lives, but the pandemic is by no means over. Educators miss their students and their students miss them, but the question of public health and our personal safety has to be at the front of our minds as we consider the return to in-person schooling. Today, I'm bringing back Alice O'Brien, our general counsel at NEA, to give us an update on the road ahead and answer our questions that we've received about returning to school buildings and your rights to safe working conditions. Thanks for coming back, Alice. We last talked a few months ago, probably more toward the beginning of self-isolation or quarantine, to talk about what everybody's rights and responsibilities and benefits were at the beginning of the pandemic in terms of we're in the middle of a school year. How are we going to handle going or not going to work as schools slowly shut down? But now that we're talking about going back to school, the landscape is looking a little different. So what's it looking like for the return to school buildings in the fall? What's changed since we last spoke?
The one thing that hasn't changed is we're still in the midst of a pandemic, and it's gotten worse in a lot of places, right? I feel like the whole world has really changed in terms of the United States just in the last month. At the beginning of June, it looked like a lot of places were on the path to reopen, and now 44 states have transmission rates for the virus that are going up. And in a number of those states, public health experts are saying that the virus is spreading in an uncontrolled manner. So what does that mean for us? It means that what everyone was thinking about in terms of the reopening of in-person instruction at the beginning of the school year now looks very different. Now it's really critical that educators focus on whether or not the preconditions to a safe reopening exist in their area, meaning are community transmission rates headed down and are those transmission rates low overall? Because that has been the path to a successful reopening in the European Union countries that have reopened schools, and where that has not been the case, where transmission rates were on the upswing or schools reopened without putting protections in place, reopening schools has been linked to a subsequent resurgence of the pandemic in an area. So the first thing that everyone should be focused on is, in my area, is the pandemic under control, as indicated by health experts in their reading as to community transmission rates in my area. And then the second thing is, if they are, has my school put in place the kind of protections that health experts recommend in order to contain the virus going forward?
So with respect to Congress and the president, there's been a lot of conflicting information about what states have the power to say, what they don't, and who has the power to make us go back to school in person. How can we make sense of what we're seeing in the news on that front?
So I don't know if there's a lot of sense to be made with some of it, but the president and Secretary of Education DeVos have been saying schools have to reopen and we are somehow going to pull federal funding or condition federal funding on schools reopening. And they haven't taken any action. They've just said that. But it's important for everyone to understand the context here, which is that the federal government provides a small portion of school funding in this country. About 10% of most school budgets come from the federal government. The rest comes from the state and from the local communities. And so obviously the federal government can't do anything about that 90% of funding, which is really what drives schools' operation at the local level. Nor can the federal government, particularly the executive branch, the president, rewrite statutes under which that 10% of federal funding flows. So federal funding flows through ESSA, through the IDEA, and it flows to schools for very particular reasons and particular purposes as delineated by Congress in those statutes. And neither the president nor DeVos has the authority to rewrite those statutes.
Well, that's helpful to know. It was sounding a lot scarier when you thought that, you know, more of the money was coming from the federal government. I mean, of course, we need every dollar we can get for our public schools, but just knowing that it's a small proportion of what they have is a little bit more comforting. So what other kinds of questions have members been asking the NEA at large about returning to work?
We have had thousands of questions from members about returning to work issues, everything from, can I require people to wear a mask in my classroom, students and colleagues to wear a mask, to what happens if I get sick, to I'm really concerned about my husband or my child at home who's in a high-risk category, and I'm really concerned about bringing the virus home to them, to infection rates in my community are surging, to I'm in a high-risk category, and do I have a right to be accommodated in some way when schools reopen in my area? NEA has done a couple of town halls for members about their rights, and we've had tens of thousands of members sign on to those town halls. We've encourage people to submit questions in advance, and close to 10,000 people did just for those town halls alone. People are anxious, I think it's fair to say, about the prospect of returning to work in the midst of this health crisis, and they really need to know what their rights are in this situation.
Well, hopefully people can use this podcast to answer some of those questions. So you talked a little bit about this, but what makes a safe school?
So the first step, which we talked about before, is the pandemic has to be under control in your area. Schools are a place where a lot of people come together and congregate for an extended period of time, and then people go home. They're very permeable, right? The staff goes home and the students go home. And so if you reopen and community transmission rates are high, that's going to mean that people going into the schools, either staff or students, are bringing the virus into the schools under conditions that likely will result in the virus to spread and bringing that virus home. So the first step is to make sure the pandemic is under control in your area. The second step is to put in place the protections that the CDC and other public health experts recommend in order to protect students and staff and also contain the virus. If and when there is someone in school with a virus, you want to make sure that the protections are in place so it isn't transmitted, so it doesn't spread. So number one, you want to protect high-risk students and staff by allowing them to learn and instruct remotely. That's what the CDC says. Second, you need to overhaul your school system or your campus, if you're an institution of higher education, to make sure that people, students and staff, can maintain a 6-foot distance around them at all times throughout the school day. And so what that means in terms of school buildings is you're going to be reducing class sizes pretty dramatically to allow that to occur, moving desks out so that students are not sitting closer than 6 feet from one another, looking at your traffic patterns, looking at your schedule in order to stagger schedules and make sure your hallways are not just stuffed full of students between class periods, looking at your arrival and departure processes to make sure that students aren't all congregated in one area for those, and that people can maintain that 6 foot of distance that the CDC recommends for safety. Number three, you want to put basic protections in place. That means that schools need to be providing masks to both students and to staff. Now, the CDC says that staff in school must wear masks and that students should. But the general advice of public health experts, and this has been evolving, is now that everybody who is developmentally able, medically able to wear a mask should wear a mask. And a number of states have mandated that everybody in schools wear masks in order to prevent the spread of the virus. You also want to make sure that everybody is regularly washing their hands and doing it correctly. Some school systems in the EU, for example, have everybody wash their hands every 2 hours. But you want some kind of pretty strict protocol in place in order to make sure people's hands are clean. You want to stop any shared materials or shared water fountains if you can't clean them between uses. And you want to increase your ventilation of outside air in order to disperse the virus in the buildings. Because it's an airborne virus, the highest risk is if you're in an enclosed space with poor ventilation with someone who's infected for an extended period of time. Fourth, there are a lot of steps here, but fourth, you want to disinfect school buildings and all of them, right? We tend to talk about school buildings like it's just the school, but it's the central office, it's the bus barn, right? It's the entire school system. You want to deep clean it and disinfect it regularly and disinfect high touch surfaces frequently throughout the school day, including bathrooms that are used the most. And fifth, you want to make sure you have solid procedures in place to detect anyone, either a staff or a student, who has COVID symptoms. You want to educate the community about what those symptoms are, encourage people to stay home. And if people end up at school, make sure you have a really clearly defined and tight process for isolating them, getting them home safely, and taking the necessary steps to disinfect where they were and to limit traffic in the areas where they were until it can be properly cleaned.
That sounds like a lot of space is needed, and having no sharing of supplies being the best rule there. I don't know about today, but when I was in school, we shared a lot. We shared books. We definitely shared pens and pencils when we needed to. Can we really expect that most schools would be able to successfully get rid of the sharing of items, of desks, and things like that when classrooms were already overcrowded and that was already a problem even under normal circumstances?
I don't want to say it's an insurmountable order, because if people want schools to reopen, even in areas where the pandemic is under control, these are the issues that educators are going to need to tackle. But educators really need to be at the table and thinking collaboratively and creatively about how the best way of getting this stuff done is. And it's going to involve engaging and persuading the community and students, right, that this is how they have to behave. And it's going to be a lot of work, both for educators, and it's going to require a huge amount of resources. So the U.S. Congress passed the HEROES Act that provides really critical funding, which is necessary for schools to have in order to even begin putting the processes in place for safe reopening. That bill is now in the Senate, and the Senate needs to act and provide schools those resources. Otherwise, there isn't any possibility that schools can put all these protections in place.
So educators are working with other people's children, but many educators have children of their own. What can educators do about their own childcare situation? What is happening with those rights and those benefits right now? I know that we talked about that a little bit earlier in the pandemic, but now has there been any change?
So not yet. We talked before, under the Families First Corona Response Act, there is paid leave available subject to certain caps for up to 12 weeks that you can use for purposes of taking care of your children. That leave can be taken on an intermittent basis, meaning not all at once, but you can take it as you need it, as long as your employer agrees to it. If you're in a bargaining state, you should definitely flag the issue as something that your local should be bargaining about, because it's a big issue for a lot of people who have children at home, particularly people who have children at home and are supposed to be providing remote instruction at the same time as their kids are supposed to be receiving remote instruction from other educators. That leave does expire at the end of this calendar year, so it's only good through December. And after that, any extension of the leave would be available only if Congress acts on the HEROES Act.
Thanks for listening to School Me, and a quick thank you to all of the NEA members listening. If you're not an NEA member yet, visit nea.org/whyjoin to learn more about member benefits. So we've talked a lot about the safety of the school. I kind of want to go to a bit of the individual issues. So what if someone gets sick? The worst case scenario, you get sick from going back. Are you entitled to compensation, or what do you have on your side in this dire situation?
So if you get sick with COVID-19, you should be entitled to sick leave under your local agreement or under the local school district policies. You also will be entitled under the Families First Corona Response Act to the quarantine leave that we talked about before, right? If you are diagnosed with COVID, you're entitled to leave under that act until you recover. But again, that's only for a total of 80 hours. If you're disabled as a result of becoming sick and you can't return to work, then you may be entitled to disability benefits under your local agreement or under state law. And if you're injured as a result of becoming sick, you may be entitled to workers' compensation. Workers' compensation is a little tricky because most states have not yet acted to recognize that people can recover under workers' compensation for COVID-19 exposure, and they also haven't put presumptions in place as to when workplace exposure results in a COVID-19 illness. And those are both really important pieces for everyone to be advocating for, because otherwise it's very difficult to get recovery from the workers' compensation system. You know, it's just hard to prove where you caught an airborne illness if you have been really strictly complying with physical distancing mandates. You want to document that before you go back to work so you can try to prove up causation if need be, and the worst case scenario happens and you get sick with COVID-19 and need to make a workers' compensation claim.
So maybe you don't get sick, but you have someone in your family who is high risk, and you're not high risk yourself, but you're just concerned about someone you take care of or someone who you'll be in contact with on a regular basis. What can you do in that situation?
So this is a really hard question, and it's one a lot of our members have. A lot of our members have contacted us and said, I'm really concerned about going back, not for myself, but because my mom lives with us, and I'm very concerned about exposing her to the virus, or my husband has a heart condition, I'm very concerned about exposing him to the virus. So the legal answer here is not as good as it should be. The ADA doesn't actually require your employer to accommodate you in order to protect a family member that has a disability. You can't be treated worse or harassed because you have a family member with a disability, but you're not entitled to an additional benefit. The Family Medical Leave Act may provide you with an option here. It only provides you with unpaid leave if you're caring for a family member who has a serious health condition as defined under that statute, and you do have to work for your employer for at least 12 months and 1,250 hours of employment. You may be able to take, you know, the limited amount of leave that's available under the Families First Corona Response Act, which provides temporary paid leave to people under certain conditions to take care of somebody who's sick with COVID.
Can you just refuse to go back? What if you just say, I don't want to go back to work? I'm too concerned about what could happen if I go. Do you have any rights to just not go and keep your job in the process?
So you really want to identify a legal claim, if you possibly have one under the ADA, to make an accommodations claim in that situation, right? If you're just concerned about COVID-19, but you don't have a health condition that puts you at risk, your best remedy is to work with your local to advocate for sufficient protections to be put in place so you and all your colleagues feel safe going back to work, and to educate the community. If you don't feel safe going back to work and your colleagues don't feel safe going back to work, your voices are trusted in the community, and it's important that you speak up. People are desperate. I think not just our members, but the community generally, people are desperate for information about how this is all going to work. And the voice of educators is really important for people to hear. I think it's really powerful for people to hear from a high school teacher, look, I interact with like 1,000 kids a day, right? That's how it usually works in my school. And now you're saying that we're going to somehow keep everybody 6 feet apart, and we're going to require everyone to wear masks, and we're not going to have a hybrid schedule, so everybody is back in my school. As a practical matter, that just doesn't work. It's important for people to hear that voice and for it to be broadcasted loudly in the debate over when and how schools reopen.
What about members who are concerned about returning to work because they are in a high-risk category?
So the CDC recognizes two pretty big groups of people. One group of people are people that have high-risk conditions, meaning conditions that the CDC has determined based on the medical evidence, put people at risk of a severe COVID-19 infection. The second category are people who have a medical condition that the CDC has recognized may put you at risk of a more severe COVID infection. And you can look at the CDC website and see where you fall. Just to give you a sense, some of the categories that the CDC recognizes actually put people at risk of a severe COVID infection are fairly common. So people who are immunocompromised, people with chronic kidney disease or a serious heart condition, people with diabetes part 2 or sickle cell disease, as well as people with a body mass index of over 30. Now, the CDC also says that people who are pregnant or people who are smokers or people who have moderate or severe asthmas, those categories are huge. They sweep in a huge number of people, are also potentially at higher risk of a severe COVID infection. So there's a lot of anxiety, and rightly so, among our members who, have those health conditions or medical conditions and about the prospect of returning to work. So what can you do? The good news is you do have rights, or you may well have rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act, because a number of the health conditions that put people at high risk or potentially at high risk are ones that are disabilities under the meaning of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And when I say disability, that's a legal term. So for purposes of the law, a disability means something that substantially limits you in the conduct of a major life activity. So for example, if you have diabetes, you often have to take injections and you often have to change what you eat, and that qualifies you as having a disability within the meaning of the ADA. If a condition requires you to change your diet or limits how you can physically exert yourself or limits how you sleep, those are all changes in a major life activity, and those would all qualify as a disability within the meaning of the ADA. So what does that mean? You have a disability within the meaning of the ADA. It also puts you at higher risk of a COVID infection. Well, it means that you have a right to an accommodation under the ADA, meaning you have the right to ask your employer to change the conditions of your work so that your work is safer and you can do it more safely. So what are the steps to getting an accommodation? Number one, and I'm going to say this a lot, you should really talk to your local about this. You can look, the NEA has basic frequently asked questions for people about accommodation rights. It's on the Educating Through Crisis website, and you want to request a reasonable accommodation. That means, something that is time limited, something that the employer could reasonably do. If you were providing remote instruction in the spring, as almost everyone was, and your school is going to reopen under a hybrid schedule, a request for a reasonable accommodation could look something like, I have this health condition and I'm asking to work remotely for the first semester due to the risk of COVID infection that this puts me at. You don't have to use any magic word to request an accommodation, and you also don't have to affirmatively offer medical evidence in support of an accommodation. When you're requesting an accommodation, you should request it of the person or department that your employer designates. So that's usually going to be your HR department. You don't want to go to your principal or your colleague and volunteer your medical condition or volunteer your accommodations need. This is a confidential process, and you should do it, with the avenue that the employer has set up for dealing with accommodation requests.
What if your school district refuses your accommodation?
So you want to respond to it, right? You want to take a look at what they're saying, and you want to ask questions and clarify what their position is. Because the employer's obligation under the ADA is to engage in an individual interactive process with you about your need for an accommodation and whether or not they can reasonably accommodate you without an undue hardship with them. So for example, it would not be permissible for an employer to just say, we are not accommodating anyone who wants to work remotely, period, without any further discussion with you about whether or not a remote instruction position is potentially available given your particular job functions in the school and who you teach. But an employer might say 60% of the teachers in our school district requested to work remotely, and 60% of the students are coming back in person, and therefore we cannot accommodate everyone, and we believe that your accommodation requests can be reasonably met by us providing you with more protective masks, smaller class size, what have you. And if that's your employer's position, you should push back for clarification. And you should be open to different accommodations than the accommodation you requested. You know, you should consider any reasonable accommodation. Your employer's obligation isn't to give you the accommodation you request. It's to engage in an interactive process to identify a reasonable accommodation. And of course, as always, you should work with your local on this, right? If your employer denies your accommodation request, your local needs to know about it, and your local can advise you as to whether or not the employer has granted other requests, under what conditions, and what areas of the employer's refusal you should really be probing in order to try to get them to move and provide you an accommodation that you believe is reasonable.
So let's say that you've gone for the accommodation and you're just not making any progress. What are the other possible avenues for getting relief or help if you can't get that from your district?
You may have an avenue for relief under your local collective bargaining agreement, right? There might be a provision for relief there. There also might be an ability to get relief under your school's general reopening plan. A lot of schools in their reopening plans do provide for some categorical accommodation for individuals who are at risk of a severe COVID infection or potentially at risk of a severe COVID infection. So those avenues should both be explored with your local. If neither of those work and your employer is not engaging in the interactive process or is, in your view, not providing a reasonable accommodation, even though it could do so without undue burden to its operations, you know, you want to consider whether or not you want to pursue some kind of legal action against your employer. And you should just be aware there are pretty tight timelines for doing that. Again, your local can assist you in figuring out what the first steps of that might be.
What if someone's district asks you to actually waive your accommodation or other rights? Is that possible?
Well, they can ask. We've heard lots of reports of school districts asking individuals to waive their rights to a safe workplace, to waive their rights under the ADA, to assume the risk of COVID-19 exposure in the workplace. And all those kinds of waiver requests, you should immediately talk to your local. I know I'm going to sound like a broken record on this, but they really need to know if the employer is asking people to sign those kind of documents. Most importantly, if the employer is out there pushing those kinds of waivers around, they basically are admitting to the world that they are not ensuring a safe school for people to return to. And, you know, everybody who sends kids into that school needs to know that. And all the people who work in the school need to know that. Number two, those kinds of waivers are not enforceable. You can't waive your rights under the ADA. You can't waive your rights to workers' compensation, which would be the main avenue for you to get a remedy if you were to get sick and injured as a result of COVID exposure at work. Many teachers are tenured. They have 10-year contracts under the law. And the school district can't change the terms of your 10-year contract by getting you to waive your rights or change that employment contract in some way. So you really need to talk to your local. You shouldn't sign those kinds of waivers. We don't believe they're effective, but in any event, you shouldn't put yourself in a hole by agreeing to them.
Alice had a lot more to share with us, so look out for part two in your feed soon. In the meantime, be sure to rate the show and help other people find us, and subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes.